Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden. Also joining us from IBM is Paul Kayata. So, Charlie, I'd like to explore, and you've touched on it a little bit, the space technology program. I had the pleasure of having Dr. Bobby Braun on a couple of years ago. It was a wonderful conversation. Could you tell us about the key priorities in this area and what are the benefits derived?
Yeah, as Bobby probably told you when he came, because he was my first space chief technologist, we are really trying to capture a way to close the technological gap between where we are and where we want to be. The ultimate goal of NASA for this nation is to put humans on Mars in human exploration. We aren't ready to get there yet. We don't have everything we need to get there. There are significant technological challenges, protection and technological and medical, protecting the crew from radiation. But that is a technological challenge to defeat a medical, you know, malady, if you will. Solar electric propulsion. How do we get large enough power packages that can transport cargo for long distances to deep space? Eventually, we will want to cut down the amount of transit time. That's a little expensive for now. So you're talking about nuclear types of propulsion, nuclear thermal, nuclear other, nuclear electric. We know that that's where we eventually want to get. So that's the primary function of the Space Technology Mission Directorate and our space technology program. Inadequately funded by the Congress, again, and no knock on the Congress, but it's just that I take the blame on not adequately explaining that there is a priority in which you do all this stuff. We need everything. We need heavy lift. We need commercial crew and cargo. We need space technology. Technology is something that those are gaps we've got to fill before you can utilize all these other things. So I'll need 130 metric ton spacecraft at some point. I can get there much better if I develop some of the technologies like composite materials for tankage that'll make it much lighter, much more resilient. Different systems for guidance and navigation, optical communication, laser comm, mainly for deep space communications. Our data limits today due to normal communications is very limited. Optical comm allows you to pack just magnitudes more data into a data stream if it's in a light beam. And so we need to be able to do that. We've experimented with optical comm, laser comm from the moon. We have a mission called LADEE that will impact the moon later this month and will end that mission. But we actually have sent both data, voice data, and imagery from LADEE back to Earth using laser comm, and it's superb. It's internet quality, internet speed, and the like. If you look at other things, whether it's atomic clocks for timing and navigation, things that are really, really critical, not just to us, but to DOD, to the intelligence community. I'll classify all this stuff as societal needs. Our society, in order to stay on the cutting edge of leadership in exploration and just living here on Earth, we need to be developing new technologies. Water resources. How do we better manage our water resources? How do we get fresh drinking water to millions of people on the planet today? Not all of them outside the United States. There are, believe it or not, there are areas in the U.S. that do not have clean drinking water day in and day out.
So, Charlie, most of what NASA does is inherently risk-oriented. I'm interested, given the reality of what you do and the missions you've outlined for us to deep space, how are you cultivating a risk-tolerant environment at NASA?
I try to be the leader, and I talk about risks all the time. I don't go out to the centers without talking to our workforce about the fact that I want them to be risk-takers, but that I want them to be smart risk-takers. For every risk that we are willing to incur, then we must put into place some risk mitigation factor. Sometimes it can be we change the system, we modify it, and we build it such that we take that risk away. Doesn't happen very often, but every once in a while you can do that. The other way is to put a procedure in place that says, okay, we are not going to keep this failure from happening, but we can keep it from killing the crew if we just put this procedure in place where they switch to an alternate system or go to a backup or do something like that. And then every once in a while you come up against a risk that is so challenging that today, with today's technology, there is no way around it. And as a general rule, what we will do then is do a risk trade-off and say, okay, is what we're about to do, is what we want to do worth exposing the crew or exposing others to that risk? If it isn't, You know, if you're not doing something that just has to be done, then you don't take that risk. You don't assume it. That's what we call trying to do smart risk taking, and we try to balance the need for the risk versus the gain if you accept it. You can look at a risk matrix. And a risk matrix generally tells us, or we use things like probabilistic risk assessment. They are tools that tell you where to put your money to buy down that risk. They don't tell you, they never tell you don't do that. They just say, okay, that's more risky than this, than that. And so we do risk-based decision making. We see what is the highest risk, and then how do we put money against it, or how do we put procedures against it, or how do we buy down that risk? And until we get to a level that's acceptable to us. So that's kind of the way we make decisions now.
Yeah, and every mission you have has a different risk calculus.
Everything has a different risk calculus. And it makes no difference how complicated it is or how simple it is. Life is full of risks. Coming on this show was,
we try to make it as painless as possible.
No, it was great. It was great, you know.
I think this fascinating discussion answers this question for me to some degree. But in the recent Partnership for Public Service Best Places to Work, NASA scored very high among its employees as the best place to work. Could you tell us a little bit about, you know, where that success, do you think, comes from?
It is real easy to identify where the source of the success is. The source of the success is in the mid-level managers in the agency. It's not the leadership, not the senior leadership. My job is to facilitate the success of the mid-level leader. And as I said again, I consider myself to be incredibly successful if I walk away and they don't even know I'm gone. And I challenge everybody in the agency all the time. I say, look, I defy you to work from anywhere. Is a thing we use for creature comfort and convenience. We try to give them the tools necessary. We try to tell them how important they are. Every day that I have an opportunity, I try to tell my folk how important they are. We really sometimes undervalue our administrative professionals, but I tell them all the time. I said, you know, I've got the number one representative for NASA is my executive assistant, Kathy Manuel. And the way that they're greeted and the way that they're treated forms a lasting impression on them about NASA. It is unbelievable the number of times I go on a trip. And I get there and somebody says, man, you are the luckiest guy in the world. You have an outstanding executive assistant. She made me feel important. She left no stone unturned. That's the reason the agency is successful. And that's the reason that the people in the agency feel that we are the best place to work.
Well, I can underscore Kathy's importance, because the reason why you're here today is because Kathy called me and said you could do it. You had an open invite. I'm glad you were able to join us. So, Charlie, I'd like to focus on the future a little bit and get your vision of the future. How do you think our space program will change over the next 5 to 10 years? And why should Americans desire an increased role for NASA in the future?
I think there are a number of changes that are already taking place and will just be expanded. The introduction of commercial entities in performing a critical role in space exploration. I tell people now, it's important for us to have a space launch system, a heavy lift launch vehicle and a crew module and the International Space Station. We have to have a way to get crews and cargo to low Earth orbit because, like I tried to say very early on, in the future, we can't afford to come back into the gravity well of Earth when we want to go into deep space every time. The farther out we can put ourselves as a base from which we operate, the easier and less expensive it is to go to deep space. So if we can go from low Earth orbit, that's still in the gravity well for all intents and purposes, but it's a lot better than starting out from here on the surface of Earth. But if we can expand our infrastructure out farther and farther until you get maybe geosynchronous orbit, you know, is the right place to be 30,000 kilometers above Earth. It may be that we start putting modules in that area. Now you're getting appreciably away from Earth's gravitational attraction that it makes it not completely easy, but even easier to get away. So we've got to have the infrastructure, and that's where commercial entities are gonna play a key role. Suborbital spaceflight, doing experiments that only need seconds to minutes of zero gravity so that you don't have to pay the expensive price of flying something all the way to orbit to spend time on the International Space Station. We hope that Virgin Galactic will fly this coming summer. That's the sort of the, you know, we hope that'll be the prototype for suborbital flight and suborbital experimentation. And the other thing that I don't discount is giving human beings an opportunity to see this planet from the vantage point that I've had. You cannot help, emotionally, you cannot help to be changed, to have your total perspective about this planet changed when you see it from the perspective of being away from it, outside our atmosphere, looking back and seeing how beautiful it is, first of all. But when you see the atmosphere, that thin blue line that just disappears if you stick your thumb up in front of one eye, you realize how fragile humanity is if we do something bad to that atmosphere. So that's important also. So I see the future being increased industry or commercial participation, increased international collaboration. We don't do anything anymore unless it's international. Our partners in the heavy lift launch vehicle, the service module for Orion will be contributed by the European Space Agency. We're looking for ways to put our other partners in on the heavy lift launch vehicle, whether they can contribute key components or what. Almost every science mission we fly is a collaboration between NASA and an international partner, if not among NASA and multiple international partners. Almost everything on Mars today is a multinational. Granted, it's our vehicle. We built it. We put it there. But it has multiple nations that are partners with us being there. Our education programs, we're making them more efficient today because we moved away. Last year, we got in trouble because we used this term consolidation, bad word. We are now moving toward something called collaboration and cooperation. So we're looking for the best programs that are available. The NASA has 50 partners around the country. Every state has a space grant consortium. That's all I have in the states is a space grant consortium. The Department of Agriculture through 4-H has partners in every single county in the United States. So we're now collaborating with 4-H, making available to them some of our NASA assets, like astronauts coming into your classroom through the miracle of downlink television. Every 4-H unit, you know, given time, can have access to that while we get their network to reach kids with our STEM education programs. Working with the Department of Education on something they called this past year 21st Century Communities in Learning, where they had a plan, they had a $5 million plan, but just didn't know exactly the best way to execute it. We came in, helped them, partnered with them. Again, we gave them content that only NASA has. Astronauts into the classroom, space technologists to go into the classroom and teach kids how to make rockets, how to talk about space exploration, the importance of the environment, the kinds of things that we do every day. As I tell Congress more and more recently, people complain about what they call cuts in our education budget. As long as our budget remains robust, $17.5 billion of the 2015 budget, if approved by the Congress, will go towards STEM education. Every single thing we do in NASA is focused on STEM education. Every directorate, every person, you know, FIRST Robotics, that's our engineers and scientists going out and volunteering their time to work with kids after hours, or going out and mentoring during work hours when they can get their supervisors to, you know, to excuse them to go out and do some community outreach. So every single one of our 17,000, almost every single one of our 17, 18,000 employees is a STEM educator. Everything we do is focused on STEM education. So I would guess a lot of federal agencies could say the same. Nobody can demonstrate it the way we do. We spend $17.5 billion this year, 17.6, on STEM education.
So, Charlie, what advice would you give someone who's thinking about a career in public service?
I'd say do it. You know, just take a deep breath and go do it. I mentioned the less than 1% who serve the nation in the military. Everybody can't do that. Everybody's not cut out to do that. We have people who, I did it for 34 years and I loved it. I loved every single second of it, and I would go do it again if given the opportunity. And now I've chosen a different realm of public service. But the military, volunteer service, Teach for America, a lot of different programs they can do. For a young person, a person who is coming out of high school and just needs to get their head on straight, military service or some volunteer program that allows them to do public service where they learn that they are not the most important person in the world, but that they can make a difference for other people, and that there is something in being a servant leader catching a college student who graduates from college, just doesn't want to go into the regular workforce, doesn't want to be pressed with trying to figure out how do I get the maximum salary right now. I just want to go out and serve. I would say those are all golden opportunities. And what I always hope is that as they do that foray into public service, they'll find that they really like it and they'll find a way to survive and subsist on it and they'll stay around.
Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. But more importantly, Paul and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Well, thank you. Thanks very much.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Charlie Bolden, administrator of NASA. My co-host from IBM has been Paul Kayata. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.